It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. It is Sound Off Sunday, December 11, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. This is episode 786 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, a very busy wrestling weekend. Only a couple of hours ago did I finally finish all of the shows from Saturday. A lot of wrestling. And I had a lot of people send me a link to that Impact Wrestling match this week with Josh Alexander and Speedball Mike Bailey. Some people calling it a match of the year contender. I've not seen it yet. I've not had time yet to watch it. I will watch it before I finalize my list. I'm doing my top 15 matches of the year, as I've done the past couple of years. And so we'll get to that at the end of the year. But I will make sure I at least watch that match beforehand to see if it makes my final cut. But ran out of time. We had Ring of Honor. We had NXT. There is a lot to get to this week. A lot of news. We have news on Sasha Banks. We have news on William Regal. We have news on Barry Windham. We have news on WrestleMania and The Rock and Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes. And oh my God. So we're going to get into all that. But first, I want to say thank you to everybody who has been supporting both via PayPal and on YouTube. We have a ton of new channel members. I mentioned the other day, our channel membership numbers are up 222% in the last 30 days. There have been a lot of people also gifting memberships to people on there. That's very kind of you. But thank you to our PayPal producers. If you want to make a donation, you are free to do so. It's entirely up to you. TheSoloMonster.com, you'll see the button at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Hey, PB, I want to say thank you very much. You know who you are. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Big B Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Killshot Keith Hart, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Shin Superkick Akuma, all of you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for your support. Also, check out the Lightning Link Lounge if you like playing games online. If you want to try to win a little bit of money, the Lightning Link Lounge is the place to be. You can play slots as well as keno and poker games like Texas Hold'em, blackjack, and roulette. Thousands of games to choose from, and they pay winners on a daily basis. For more information, search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok. You must be 18 years or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S., and ID is required. Just text 727-910-8809 to get started. This Saturday, House of Glory is back with Revelations from Club La Boom in Queens, New York. We've got a rematch 17 years in the making. For the first time since their Ring of Honor clash in 2005, Kenta battles Low-Ki. That is Kenta's Hog debut. We've got Jacob Fatu defending his House of Glory World Championship for the first time against Nick Aldis. The Briscoes, after their brutal, bloody, violent dog collar match yesterday with FTR, winning back the Ring of Honor tag team titles. They put their House of Glory tag team titles on the line against the main event, Midas Black and Jay Lyon. And Violet defends the House of Glory Women's Championship against Masha Slamovich. So I'll be on the call with JD from New York. Tickets are available at hogwrestling.net. We are closing out 2022 in a big way. We've got a hell of a lineup, and that's not even all the matches. You can go to HOG social media for the full card, but it's going to be a hell of a show next weekend. Now, speaking of weekends and a hell of a show, can say the same about the shows that I watched yesterday. We had two pay-per-views yesterday, back-to-back, with Ring of Honor and NXT. NXT, I thought, was good. Ring of Honor was very good. I thought it was the better of the two shows, but they were both very enjoyable. We'll go through these two shows. This is just my top-line thoughts. I'm focusing on the key stuff here. On the Ring of Honor side, we had Athena winning the Ring of Honor Women's World Championship from Mercedes Martinez. And Athena was very over in her hometown, even though she's been showing more of an aggressive side. She's been working more like a heel. She was not treated and greeted by the fans that way in Texas yesterday. I thought they had a very good match. And, you know, Tony Khan on the media call the other day said that he thinks Athena is doing the best work of her career right now. And she was on Busted Open Radio earlier in the week, and she addressed the criticism that she has gotten lately for working too stiff. And this is what she had to say. She said, "A lot of people don't know that for 10 years, before I signed with WWE, I was probably one of the most notorious villains in wrestling. I worked my entire indie career as the bad guy going around. I even got given the nickname American Joshi because of my hard-hitting style, and I think people just forgot about that. And honestly, throughout my entire TV career, it's always something that I've wanted to get back to." And she agreed with Thunder Rosa's point. Thunder Rosa was co-hosting the show about there being, you know, a bit of a double standard about men being physical versus the women being physical in pro wrestling. And she said, you know, people forget that the girls can hit just as hard as the guys, and I have to sit here and see Jon Moxley and Chris Jericho and other people, all these guys, you know, beating the hell out of each other. And I guarantee you that if I was a man, I feel like there wouldn't be as much backlash against it. And I agree with her. I think she makes a very valid point, which is why I didn't make a big fuss about the match that she had in Toronto with Jody Threat when a lot of other people did. And she's right. You know, if that was Walter, or if they brought someone in, as AEW does very often, we've seen it with Suzuki, we've seen it with Ishii, you know, if they bring in someone from New Japan, those same people, if they were to work a harder style and lay their shit in, people would have been praising it. And a lot of times when we see some of the women out there, it does look like a dance. There's another point that she made that, you know, on the one hand, you have people complaining, well, it looks like a dance when the women are out there and they're barely touching each other. But then if they lay their shit in, it's like, oh, well, they're being unprofessional. They don't know how to work and blah, blah, blah. And it's one of the things I love about Jamie Hayter's matches, how aggressive she is. So you can, on the one hand, say, oh, it looks like they're barely touching each other when they're out there. And then when you have someone who's really laying their stuff in and trying to make it look good, oh, well, she's being reckless. Now, if the person is being reckless and she's working with other wrestlers who are being injured and are being hurt, that's a different story. I'm not aware of, you know, there being multiple instances of Athena working with people who then end up injured and unable to wrestle. So if that's the case, that's a totally different story. But I think she's bang on, you know, with the point that she made. I think she's absolutely right. And I'm enjoying this new attitude from her. I'm glad they put the championship on her. And I thought they had a very good match. Now, we had Swerve in Our Glory, Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland, with a win over Shane Taylor and J.D. Griffey, making his first appearance in Ring of Honor. I've never seen this guy before, but I figured he was in there for one reason and one reason only. He was in there to be the punching bag, or he was in there to take the losing fall. I thought that they would actually give the win to Shane Taylor, but it worked out exactly the way that I figured, where you had Swerve walking out on his partner. Only Keith Lee did not lose. Keith Lee still went on to win the match. But Swerve Strickland giving Keith Lee a little taste of his own medicine for what he did to him at Full Gear. They were working on the same page, pretty much, up until Keith Lee inadvertently hit, you know, Strickland. And at that point, you had to imagine that he was going to be walking out on him, and he did. So they're continuing the story with Keith Lee and Swerve. The match itself, I thought, was a lot of fun. And I don't know what Shane Taylor's contractual status is with Ring of Honor, if he's officially signed or what, but he definitely should be a part of that roster, I think, moving forward. We had the Embassy winning the six-man tag team titles from Dalton Castle and the Boys. Yeah, they don't need them. You know, Dalton Castle and the Boys, they don't need them. They've had them for a while. Now would be a good time to give Dalton Castle, I think, and start, or at least start building him towards another singles run. You know, I know he got derailed years ago with the back injury. He's still, you know, his back, he's not the same performer that he was, you know, 5 years ago. And he's 5 years old. But he's still very over. You know, he can still work. He had a fun match with Chris Jericho for the Ring of Honor World title, you know, several weeks ago on TV. Now would be a good time to get him away from the six-man stuff and start building him towards something in the singles division. We had Wheeler Yuta taking back the Pure Championship from Daniel Garcia. I look at this, and these two had a very good match. If you like that pure wrestling style, and you're not completely sick of seeing these two in the ring together and the whole JAS and BCC feud, which I am sick of, and hopefully last night was the, or yesterday I should say, was the end of it. But I'm amazed as I watch this, how they dropped the entire thing with Daniel Garcia and what it looked like they were building to, where he was going to make a split from Jericho and the JAS. And they were kind of trending in that direction, and he was starting to get over, at least, you know, with the AEW audience and the reactions that he was getting, and they just abandoned the entire thing just to throw him right back into the Jericho Appreciation Society when he was starting to get over as a babyface. And now it's just, he just feels like another face in the crowd. But the work here was very good. Wheeler Yuta takes back the Pure Championship. Daniel Garcia does not shake his hand, but he, you know, very aggressively hands the title off to him as he walks away. So I thought this was good stuff. And then we had the finale of what will go down as one of the best trilogies I've seen in many, many years, with the Briscoes and FTR for the Ring of Honor World Tag Team Championship, a match that was not even announced for the show until 4 days ago. They took these two teams, they put them in the ring together, they strapped dog collars around their neck, and they basically said, go out there and give the people what they want. And what these four men went out there and did is they proved, first of all, that tag team wrestling is still alive and well and strong. But they went out there and they staked their claim to being two of the best tag teams in this entire business, and two of the best tag teams that will go down for this entire decade. I mean, the Briscoes have been doing it for 20 years. FTR's had a career year. Dax Harwood has had a career year, both in tag matches and singles matches. The work they've been pumping out has just been incredible. And these four guys went out there and they had what I thought, looking back on it now, and I enjoyed the first two matches. I thought the second match was better than the first. I think the third match was better than the second. This is one of those instances where the matches got progressively better. This is a very different type of match than the first two matches they had. The first two matches they had, you know, they were stiff, they were fights, but they were wrestling matches, by and large. You know, there were tables and things like that involved. This was just a fight. This was about violence, this was about brutality, this was about blood, and that's what the dog collar stipulation is, right? First dog collar match I ever saw, which was years after it happened, but the first dog collar match I ever saw was Roddy Piper and Greg Valentine, right? That was a pretty violent match. It's hard to have a match where you are chained by the neck to another man and not have it be violent. All right, and not have people bleed. You wanted blood, you got plenty of blood here. If you don't have the stomach or the appetite for it, then this was not the match for you. We had double juice here in this match. And honestly, you know what this felt like to me? This felt like WWE adding a ladder match to the SummerSlam card in 1995 at the last minute to try to add some juice to the show. Pun intended, we got plenty of juice here. We're trying to add some juice to the show. They felt like they needed something bigger than what they already had. They were going to do Shawn Michaels against Psycho Sid on the show. They already had a main event of Mabel against Diesel. And so I'm sure Vince McMahon and Bruce and all of them, they looked at this and said, we got to do better than this. And so they decided to do Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon Part 2. In a ladder match for the Intercontinental title, and it blew away everything else on the card. It's my favorite of the two ladder matches that they had. I think it's better than WrestleMania. Not as memorable or as legendary as WrestleMania, but it was the better match of the two. And you know, this felt the same. Tony Khan waited until a few days before the show to throw that third match out there to try to make this pay-per-view must-see. And it worked. You had Jay Briscoe tied to Dax Harwood. Mark Briscoe was chained to Cash Wheeler, and it didn't take very long. Mark Briscoe was busted open, then Jay Briscoe was busted open, and Dax ended up busted open, and they were just beating the holy hell out of each other. This was a blow-off to the feud, is what this felt like. It felt like this trilogy was progressively building to the point where you had to expect they were going to have a match like this down the road at some point. I wasn't expecting it to happen yesterday, but this blew away everything else, not just on this show, but the NXT show as well. This was an incredible spectacle. is what this match was. And I said coming into it, the Briscoes could not afford to lose three straight. They lost the first two to FTR, but the Briscoes are the ones with the Ring of Honor contracts, not FTR. The Briscoes are going to be on that roster when that weekly show launches, not FTR. They had to win here. Putting the belts back on the Briscoes was the right call. They are the new Ring of Honor World Tag Team Champions. And if you did not see this match, if you saw the other two, you didn't see this one, make it a point to watch this one because this will go down. You know, we're talking about end of the year, match of the year. What's going to be number one? What's going to be on the list? I won't tell you where this will rank on my list, but you know, you take these three matches and you put these matches up against anything that happened this year. These two teams went out there and they staked their claim as to why they are the best when it comes to, and there's a lot of great tag teams, but you will not find any better than these two teams right here. Samoa Joe and Juice Robinson, you know, look, they had a tough time following that. Anything was going to have a tough time following that match. But the fans love seeing Joe. So they stuck with it. Samoa Joe retains his Ring of Honor television title over Juice Robinson. He remains the king of television. It was a good match. He was the star of the post-show scrum, too. He came in there, man. He commanded that room. He said he'll take on all comers for the title. It doesn't matter who it is. It can be Miro. He said it could be Cody. So there you go. Cody back to AEW confirmed. That'll be the headlines, I'm sure, on some websites now. The main event was Claudio Castagnoli challenging Chris Jericho for the Ring of Honor World Championship with the stipulation that if Claudio lost, he would be forced to join the Jericho Appreciation Society and probably wear one of those stupid hats that Jake Hager wears. I had no interest in seeing Claudio joining the JAS and dragging this out even longer. 7 months. We have had the BCC and the JAS. 7 months is long enough. Thankfully, Final Battle looks to be final when it comes to this feud. These two went out there and also had a very good main event match. It could not hold a candle to FTR and the Briscoes. But given the finish that they did and the big celebration at the end with Claudio, I can see why Tony Khan wanted to headline with this and not the tag team match. But nothing on this show is going to top what we got in the dog collar match. So this was good. It could not match the intensity and the action in that match, though. But I love the finish. And like a lot of other people, it's not a finish I ever would have imagined. But we had Chris Jericho caught in the giant swing, and Claudio gave him over 30 spins, over 30 revolutions. He held on to this man until Jericho started tapping in mid-swing. He tapped out to the giant swing. I have never seen that before in my life. But I loved it. Because think about it. I mean, this guy could have gone another 30, right? Jericho, he's going to start projectile vomiting all over the place. At some point, you're going to have to tap out. So, I mean, you could say, oh, well, you know, who would tap out from a move like that? Well, if somebody tried to spin you around 35 times, you might tap out too. So I like the finish. It was very unique. I wouldn't be surprised if that was something Jericho himself came up with. And if he did, I'm sure he'll tell us about it on his podcast. But, you know, to talk about Jericho here for a second and his run that he had, and it wasn't very long. It wasn't even a full 3 months. He won the Ring of Honor World title from Claudio at Grand Slam back in September. And since that time, he churned out some really fun matches on TV and pay-per-view. Against Claudio. Against Bryan Danielson. Against Bandido. Against Ishii. Against Dalton Castle. Of course, there was the four-way at Full Gear, which was excellent. So, whatever you think of Jericho and his push or his presence or his music or whatever, you gotta give him props. He's turning out quality matches. You know, even at his age, as long as he's been doing this for... it wasn't a long run, thankfully. It shouldn't have been that long of a run anyway. But I think, you know, we'll look back on this Ring of Honor run in terms of the matches he had as being pretty impressive when you see, you know, what he was able to churn out during that period. But now Claudio has the belt back, which he should. Claudio is now the champion again. And now all of this leads to what is next? What is the next step? What is the next phase, the next chapter for Ring of Honor? Because we have been getting a stream of Ring of Honor matches on AEW television to the point where, you know, a lot of people don't like it. A lot of people are sick of it. I'm sick of it. And at some point, there has to be an announcement of what is next as far as TV, for example, for Ring of Honor. And Tony Khan has been very mum. He's been having negotiations and conversations, and he just hasn't said anything. He keeps saying, oh, well, you know, soon. There'll be news soon. Well, we finally got some news. And I knew it was going to be a downer when Tony got asked about it at the scrum. And then instead of answering the question, he took 15 minutes to get to the answer. So I knew. I said, okay, if there was some big announcement, if it was going to be on cable or it was something, you know, major, HBO Max or something like that, that would have been the first thing out of his mouth when he sat down in that media scrum. And the fact that later on, finally, when one of the women there asked him a question about this, and it took him 15 minutes to finally answer her question, I said, okay, well, this is not going to be the announcement I think that people were expecting. And the announcement is as follows. They have officially relaunched Honor Club, which was the streaming service that Ring of Honor had set up back when they were still owned by Sinclair Broadcasting. And it was suspended after Tony Khan bought the company until they figured out what to do with it and to build it out a little bit more. So they have officially relaunched Honor Club. You go to watchroh.com. You can see what the website looks like. For $9.99 a month, their weekly show, starting in 2023, we don't have an exact date yet, but starting next year, their weekly show is going to live on Honor Club. And in addition to having access to the weekly television show, if you're a member, if you're a paying subscriber, you'll have access to the Ring of Honor library dating all the way back to their first shows in 2002. They're talking 2,500 hours of content at launch. There will be a 90-day delay in posting the latest pay-per-views after they first air on Bleacher Report. That will continue, because Tony Khan wants to maintain the current relationship with Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns Bleacher Report, and the pay-per-views have done pretty well. So that will not change. The Ring of Honor pay-per-views, however many there are in a given year, will still air live on Bleacher Report, and they will not hit Honor Club until 90 days later. Now, he also said that there will be New Japan involvement with the weekly show, but he did not specify exactly what that means. When the start date will be. He did say he wants to wait until after Wrestle Kingdom next month to do that. He didn't specify what the taping schedule is going to look like. I think Ring of Honor needs to have its own distinct look and feel. I mean, look at the show yesterday, right? They don't have the entrance tunnels like AEW has. It's a basic setup, but they have their own setup. And so I don't think they should be using the same set and the entrance tunnels that AEW has. So taping Ring of Honor, for example, before Dynamite or Rampage, let's say, if they were to start doing combo ROH Rampage tapings, would not really allow them to do that. It would just look like it does now, taping Ring of Honor matches at an AEW show. I don't think that's what you want. I think you want to keep the two separate. And, you know, what day of the week? That's the other question, right? What day of the week does the show stream? There's already so much wrestling in a given week. My God, right? Mondays are out. Wednesdays are out. Fridays are out. The weekends are not ideal because those are for the pay-per-views. So I think you have either Tuesday nights at 10 following NXT, or you have Thursdays. And I know there's Impact on Thursdays in New Japan, but you find a time on Thursdays. Tuesday or Thursday to me would seem like the most likely date as far as when the show would stream or drop, you know, whatever word you want to use. But putting the weekly show behind a paywall on their streaming service after all of these months, it's pretty clear Tony Khan shopped it around. There was no interest in a Ring of Honor television product, be it on a cable network or a bigger streaming service. There was no interest in Ring of Honor. I think it's good that he is going to be toning down the ROH involvement on AEW television. He did say that. But this has to be seen as a disappointment. There's no other way to spin it. You know, whatever diehard Ring of Honor fans are left will likely pay for it. I'm sure not all of them will, but you know, they'll likely pay for it. The New Japan involvement does have me curious, you know, as far as what form that takes. And it is nice to have that library as part of your subscription, right? It's not unlike what the WWE Network was. But after all these months of waiting for news about a Ring of Honor television show, and sitting here to watch all these AEW shows with all this Ring of Honor influence and the Ring of Honor storylines and the Ring of Honor title matches, after all these months, throwing it on Honor Club feels like something that could have been done months ago. But again, he tried to get a TV deal with Warner Brothers Discovery, and they balked. and he didn't want to throw it up on YouTube for free, I'm guessing, only to then pull it off there and then start charging people for it months later on their own service. Hey, you've been giving this to me for free for so long, now you want me to pay for it. Because if so, otherwise, that could have been done months ago. They could have put it on Honor Club, they could have put it on YouTube. And I know Tony Khan has said he didn't want to do YouTube because he feels Ring of Honor is above that. Ring of Honor deserves better than YouTube. Whether or not Ring of Honor deserves better than, you know, a free stream on YouTube is not dictated by Tony Khan. It's dictated by these networks that he's pitching. And it's dictated by the audience. If the audience is there for it, they'll dictate whether or not it's worthy of being on a cable network or on YouTube or whatever. But obviously, he couldn't get the interest that he was looking for. Otherwise, this would have been done months ago. They put the championship on a big name in Chris Jericho. Why do you think they did that? They put the title on Chris Jericho as a way to make the product more appealing and more attractive to potential partners. And it didn't work. You know, Jericho was a very big part of the foundation of AEW when the company was first founded. He was the AEW champion. He was, you know, still pretty fresh at that point off WWE television. He had a name people knew. So I don't fault Tony Khan for going to that well again and trying again. It didn't work. It didn't work this time. There's one fact that Tony Khan cannot do anything about. And that is the fact that the market is already oversaturated when it comes to weekly pro wrestling. There's a lot of it. There's Raw and SmackDown. There's NXT. There's Dynamite and Rampage, there's Impact, there's MLW, there's New Japan on Access, there's WOW Women of Wrestling on their syndicated show in different markets, Billy Corgan has his weekly NWA shows on YouTube, and now Ring of Honor, right? It's too much. It saturates the market for everybody. There's only so many hours in a week. So I can appreciate that Tony Khan is a longtime big fan of Ring of Honor. He rescued the company. He's going to try to do something with it that Vince McMahon never would have. Vince McMahon would have bought the company, picked the bones, and that would have been it. Ring of Honor would have been a tape library. It would have been a tab on Peacock. Tony Khan thinks Ring of Honor should be more than a tab on Peacock. All right, so you'll be able to watch Ring of Honor on Honor Club. I don't know how that grows the company or anything like that. He tried. It didn't work. I just think after all these months, for that to be the announcement can't be seen as anything other than a disappointment. Doesn't mean they can't try again, and maybe if they establish the brand a little bit more next year, he goes back to the well later in 2023. But I think he's got bigger issues to deal with when it comes to television rights in 2023. I'm going to talk about that here in a few minutes. But before I do, let's flip on over to the other show from yesterday, which was NXT Deadline. The Iron Survivor concept. We had our first two Iron Survivor challenge matches ever. And the Iron Survivor concept is a winner that I think is here to stay, and it should be. I think they've hit on something fun with this. It has elements of the old scramble matches, which I personally was never really a fan of. But they tweaked it. It's got elements of the Royal Rumble in there. It's got elements of the Iron Man match as well, but they're not as long and drawn out as those 60-minute matches. They keep it to 25 minutes. I think that's a good length. So, you know, you have the clock adding to a sense of urgency and energy that made it fun, especially in those last few minutes of both matches, right? They were very dramatic in those final minutes as people were scrambling to try to, you know, gain some last-minute falls. The penalty box concept works. You know, when one person loses a fall, you lock them in a box for 90 seconds so they can't gain any falls, right? That's their punishment. I'm not sure they need the staggered entrances, though, which is kind of the rumble element of the match. Since you win the match based on points, it seems unfair to have people first entering the match with only 5 or 10 minutes left as opposed to starting them all at the same time. You start with a less cluttered field that way, I get that, but I wouldn't want to be the person entering the match last. I just don't think that's fair to that person. But, you know, NXT is a place where they can try new things. I called it, it's their petri dish. They can try new things. They could try to create these things that haven't existed before. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they don't. They needed something to replace War Games. I mean, Shawn Michaels flat out said, we lost War Games. We had to come up with something new. And I think they found their match. Now, the men's Iron Survivor was the better of the two, but the women's match was very good also. always felt like there was something going on, never a dull moment. There was a sense of urgency there. Roxanne Perez starts the match. She goes on to win the entire thing with only two falls. And so she wins the Women's Iron Survivor match. I thought Kiana James was the standout. And yet she was the only one not to pick up a fall in the entire match. I don't care for her character, but she's shown a lot of potential in what I've seen from her. And as I predicted, you know, Roxanne wins. And then I think what happens is she goes on to end Mandy Rose's stranglehold on the NXT Women's Championship. And from there, Perez drops the title to Tiffany Stratton. You know, maybe WrestleMania weekend. Tiffany Stratton has the greatest potential out of any of the women that I have seen down there in NXT. They aired a vignette on this show for a woman, a blonde. We couldn't see who it was. But it was a vignette hyping this person's arrival at New Year's Evil on January 10th. And again, they didn't show us who it was, but that could be for Tiffany Stratton. She has been out with an injury since her Lights Out match in August with Wendy Chu. I believe she's ready to come back, so that might be her return date, and the timing is perfect. Especially if on that same night, if they do the title match with Roxanne and Mandy, and Roxanne wins, and that's the same night that Tiffany Stratton returns, you start building to the eventual match between them. I'm thinking it's Stand and Deliver. That would be the best time to do it. We had Isla Dawn getting a win over Alba Fire. Alba Fire hit a Swanton Bomb, had the match won. But the referee starts vomiting black goo and collapses in the corner. This new COVID strain is wild, I have to say. So that's the same referee that Isla Dawn missed it in the face by accident on Tuesday when she was aiming for Alba in their pull apart. I hope this isn't a chronic illness that this man now has. Another referee is sent out to check on him. Isla Dawn then runs Alba Fire headfirst into the exposed middle turnbuckle and wins the match. I thought they were having a pretty solid match up until the goofy ass finish. That just killed the entire thing for me. The New Day are the new NXT Tag Team Champions. They beat Pretty Deadly. I figured after SmackDown on Friday night that Imperium would get involved and cost the New Day the match. So I was very surprised when they actually pulled the trigger on this title change. They had a really fun match. Kofi Kingston now makes history. He's the first man to 15 tag team titles, beating out Edge and Booker T, who each had 14. So now Kofi holds the record. That may have had something to do with how over the top Booker T was on commentary about being disgusted that the New Day came to NXT and they got a tag team championship match, how they came out of nowhere. He said they stole, you know, an opportunity from the Young Stars. His logic is not wrong. New Day literally showed up on the go-home show, and they were granted a tag team title match. So he's not wrong. But the New Day also were not touching the Usos anytime soon. The Usos are going to have those tag team titles at least through WrestleMania. And it's not the New Day who are going to be taking the titles from them. So what do you do in the meantime with Kofi and Xavier? Shawn Michaels said, well, if they're not in the middle of anything major, if they're not being used, hey, Paul, can I use them? And Triple H is like, yeah, sure. And so it gives them something to do with the idea that they might be able to help sell tickets for their Vengeance Day show. NXT is going back out on the road for the first time in a while. And February 4th in Charlotte is the date. They're going to be running, you know, a big NBA arena. They're going to have to sell tickets. And it's not unlike this year when they had Dolph Ziggler come in, right? This was around WrestleMania time. It's the same logic, right? We need some main roster talent that we can advertise who can help move some extra tickets. And to me, I think that's all this is. And as a strategy, I think it makes sense. You're going to run a big building. They're not selling out the building or anything. They'll probably fit it for, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000, somewhere in that range, even though it fits about 19. You know, but it's a smart move to try to tap into that main roster talent to try to move a few extra tickets. Grayson Waller wins the Men's Iron Survivor Challenge with three falls to two falls for Axiom, two for Joe Gacy, two for Carmelo Hayes, and none for JD McDonagh. Yesterday was not a good day on these shows for people named JD. I like the finish with him stealing the pin from Carmelo Hayes and then running away for the final 20 seconds as everybody chased after him. All he had to do was run out the clock. right? It's smart strategy. That's what I would have done if I was in the same position. There's no countouts, so I would have run right out of the building. I would have had my luggage waiting for me. I would have had a car engine running. I would have jumped right into the car. I would have been out of there. He's a prick heel, and that's what prick heels do. Everyone had a chance to shine. I'm not sold on Grayson Waller as being a top champion. The guy does get a lot of heat, so I think setting him up to challenge Braun for the NXT title in New Year's Evil is fine. I presume that's where the match is going to take place. I don't think they officially said that. I had Carmelo Hayes winning, but if they put that off for one of the bigger shows, I don't have a problem with that. You know, Bron Breakker retained his NXT title against Apollo Crews in the main event. They had a good match. I don't know where they go with Apollo after this. Shawn Michaels, after the show, said that he has no intention of letting him go anywhere when he was asked about him going back to the main roster. He said they absolutely have a plan for Apollo going forward. We'll see what that plan is. But Breakker retaining was the right call. Now he goes to New Year's Evil. He beats Grayson Waller. I think you want to have at least one of your Iron Survivor winners go on to win their respective title. I think that's going to be Roxanne Perez. I don't think that's going to be Grayson Waller. That then paves the way for them, once NXT hits the road again in the bigger venues, to do Bron Breakker against Carmelo Hayes for the NXT Championship. Either at Vengeance Day, they could do it there, or they could do it at Stand and Deliver, WrestleMania weekend. If they're going back out on the road, they should do that match in a bigger venue anyway. Before one or both of them get called up to the main roster, we should get Bron Breakker and Carmelo Hayes for the NXT Championship. And if you're going to do it in a bigger building. So Deadline was a good show. A lot of really good wrestling. A lot of great wrestling to be had on Saturday. But with that out of the way, I did say that this was a very news-heavy week. And as we break into the news here, I think that the big story to tap into first concerns Sasha Banks. It's been a while since we've had any real news on the future of Sasha Banks. That is no longer the case. PW Insider reported exclusively on Thursday, and Dave Meltzer has since confirmed the news, that Mercedes Varnado, or Varnado, aka Sasha Banks, is scheduled to be at New Japan Pro Wrestling's Wrestle Kingdom 17 event next month. And the report says, while it is unknown whether she will be appearing before the live crowd, we are told that New Japan is bringing her in for the event. Meltzer says the deal is to bring her in, not through WWE. It is not happening through WWE. And New Japan believes that she will be free and clear to appear at the show by January 4th. The idea of Sasha working even just a few shows in Japan is hardly a surprise. When New Japan and Stardom first announced the creation of an IWGP Women's Championship, on Sound Off Episode 767, I said the first name that came to mind when I heard about the new title was Sasha Banks. I said that in July. In October, she teased the idea of wrestling Kairi in Stardom, and Kairi shared that on Twitter. That got people talking. Kairi is defending the IWGP title at Wrestle Kingdom against Tam Nakano. So Sasha would not be wrestling on that show, but if they're flying her in for it, there ain't no way she doesn't appear on camera. She's not flying over there, I think, to be a ticket-holding fan in the crowd, or just to have a seat in the backstage area, right? If she's being flown in, if New Japan is bringing her in, they are not bringing her in to not put her on camera in some way, shape, or form. My guess is that she's going to show up after Kairi retains her title for a face-off to tease the match. Or, I mean, I guess they could put a video up, but it would be more impactful, I think, for her to be there and to come out and have a face-to-face teasing a championship match. There is a second night of Wrestle Kingdom later in the month on January 21st at the Yokohama Arena. That's the same building they sold out earlier this year for their third night of Wrestle Kingdom when they did the New Japan vs. Pro Wrestling Noah card. This year, they're only doing two nights of Wrestle Kingdom, and there's a gap of a few weeks between the shows. But that would be a great place for that match to happen. Sting and Darby Allin are going to be wrestling in that same building 24 hours after that, tagging with the great Muda in Muda's retirement match. Meltzer did say in The Observer that there is a plan for the IWGP Women's title to be defended in the United States on February 18th in San Jose. And when the title was first conceived, the idea was for it to be defended mostly in Stardom matches on New Japan cards in the US. Stardom and New Japan, they're owned by the same parent company. So whether it's the 21st in Japan or whether it's the following month in California, that would be huge for them if they could get Sasha Banks to wrestle, even if just for one match. What that means for her future in WWE is unknown. They still have her listed on their roster page. If you go to WWE.com in the Superstars section, I believe it's the SmackDown Raw. Actually, no, it would be the Raw roster. But if you go to the Superstars page, she's still listed there. They never took her off. When people tried to book her earlier this year after she walked out with Naomi, promoters were told she's not taking any wrestling bookings until after January 1st. Well, here we are, and she'll be at Wrestle Kingdom on January 4th. That tells me that she'll be a free agent as of the first of the year. Remember, in June, after they walked out, there were stories of her lawyers working to get her out of her deal. Right? We heard about the lawyers and the conversations with WWE, but we never heard exactly where those conversations went. I don't think her lawyer just decided one day to pack up and go home. So we don't know what the outcome of those conversations was. If they did get her out of her deal, there may have been a non-compete that runs out at the end of the year, which would make these stories make sense. Because it would be weird if she was still under her original deal and under contract to WWE, while New Japan is flying her in for the show. New Japan is not going to tamper with a WWE contract and run the risk of getting into legal trouble. So if they're flying her in for the show and there's communication between her and New Japan, then they must know that it is legally safe for them to be doing so. Now, a few weeks ago, she posted that she just wrapped filming on her first movie in Boston. She was really excited about that. I could absolutely see her wanting to have the freedom to do her own thing. She's been training in the ring in different places, both in the US and in Mexico. She posted pictures on social media of her, you know, in the ring with students, just trying to stay in ring shape and train and prepare for an eventual in-ring return. Interestingly, none of those places that she's been seen training at is the WWE Performance Center. Another sign of what I think is her preparing for life after WWE were the trademarks that she recently filed for, both for her given name and for her other names, Mercedes Moné, Moné Talks, Bank Moné, and Statement Maker. She trademarked all of these names. That doesn't sound to me like someone who's planning a WWE return anytime soon. It sounds like someone who's been preparing for life after WWE. And has just been waiting out whatever time she has left on her deal or her non-compete so she can start taking bookings. That's what it sounds like to me. She knows that she can go back to WWE anytime that she wants, and Triple H is going to welcome her back with open arms. You think if she comes knocking on their door, they're going to bar the building and not let her back inside? Are you kidding me? They would love to have Sasha back. I'm sure Triple H has been working to try to get her back. So she knows that WWE will always be there. But why not travel around and work other places? Make 2023 the year of Mercedes. I've heard nothing about Naomi, other than Naomi was seen sitting with Jade Cargill at the Atlanta Hawks game earlier in the week. Sasha and Naomi, they can do their own thing. Where one goes, the other one doesn't have to go. But all of this has led to speculation about Sasha Banks going to AEW. Because AEW has a working agreement with New Japan, so she could sign with AEW and still do stuff there if she wanted to. We have a Wrestle Kingdom show coming up. Think about this. We have a Wrestle Kingdom show coming up with the return of Kenny Omega wrestling Will Ospreay. FTR is expected to be defending their IWGP tag belts on that show. There's talk of Carl Anderson possibly working the Tokyo Dome to defend his never open weight title if he doesn't drop it to Hikuleo this Wednesday, because he's working the New Japan Tag League finals this week. I think both good brothers are going over there to Japan. And we're going to have the first IWGP women's title defense ever at the Tokyo Dome, Kairi defending against Tam Nakano. So there is a nice mix of different things on that show. Wrestle Kingdom is already going to have all the buzz that week, but now that buzz is going to be even louder. And they don't even have to announce Sasha for the show, even as a guest, because now the word has leaked. Everybody already knows. Everybody's talking about it. They don't have to say a word. But there is speculation about who will be Saraya's tag team partner for her match with Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter when Dynamite returns to the Kia Forum in Los Angeles on January 11th. That's going to be a very big episode of Dynamite. AEW just made their debut there in June. That was the first Dynamite after Double or Nothing, the night that CM Punk broke his foot and fucked up all Tony Khan's creative plans for the summer. On Dynamite this week, Britt Baker presented Saraya with tickets to the show and said, you can either sit in the front row and watch me, or you can get back in the ring. And Saraya said, oh, I'd love to beat you again. And that's when Britt told her, no. If you want to fight me, you'll have to find a partner to fight me and Jamie Hayter. Now, on the stream the other night, I dismissed the idea of that person being Sasha Banks. This was the day before the news broke about her being flown in for Wrestle Kingdom. I still don't think it's going to be her, but I cannot outright dismiss that anymore. It is possible. Toni Storm or Thunder Rosa would make sense for that spot. Toni did that promo with two black eyes coming out of full gear, saying that she broke her face losing the championship. She'll break her face again to win it back if she has to. So she has made it very clear she is not done with Jamie Hayter. Thunder Rosa? She was forced to finally relinquish her AEW Women's Championship only a couple of weeks ago. She has talked about hoping to be back in the ring from her back injury sometime in February. She was recently able to start doing squats with a 2-pound dumbbell. A few weeks ago, she was able to do a 5K run, but she only ran half of that. She walked the other half. I don't doubt that she's really hurt, but AEW is going to be in her hometown of San Antonio for Dynamite on December 21st. It's always possible that she's kayfabing the recovery timeline to throw people off, and she shows up in San Antonio. Maybe to save Saraya from an attack, and it's revealed that she's going to be the mystery partner because in San Antonio, you can count on her getting a big reaction. Other places, she might not get a big reaction. But in San Antonio, you know that the fans will be behind her. Now, I don't know how likely that is. If they know that she's going to be back in a few weeks, it begs the question, why strip her of the title in the first place? If the mystery partner is not Sasha Banks, though, they have to announce it in advance who it's going to be. I think people are assuming that we won't know until the actual show. They never said that. All Saraya said at the end of the segment on Wednesday was, I'll find a partner. We could find out this week who the partner is going to be. They never said that it was going to be a mystery until January 11th. But if it's anyone but Sasha, they have to let people know in advance who it is. Because now, you know, with this Wrestle Kingdom announcement, you know, AEW has a very insider fan base. That you can say that casuals would not be thinking Sasha. It's just the internet, right? Speculating and doing what it always does. But let's be honest, that's the majority of AEW's fan base. So now you're going to have 4 weeks of speculation, potentially building this up to be more than it is. Better to announce who it is in advance if it's not her, than let it stew, and then no matter who it is, people feel let down by something that AEW never actually promoted. AEW never said the name CM Punk either when they announced the first dance in Chicago, but they knew their audience would figure it out. They didn't have to say his name. And they did over 1 million viewers for Rampage, which will never happen again. And they packed 15,000 people into the United Center. If we ring in the new year and we still don't know who Saraya's partner is, I will be a lot less convinced that it's not Sasha Banks teaming with Saraya. There were people thinking maybe the stuff with Jade and Bow Wow was going to lead to Sasha coming in to challenge Jade Cargill for the TBS Championship. Then we saw Naomi with Jade at the basketball game. I don't know how good of a match it would be. I think Sasha would give her the best match of her life, but I think that would be an uphill battle for her. There's a history there with Sasha being the one who was in the ring with Saraya, kicked her in the back, ended her career 5 years ago, right? There's history there. They could work with that. Sasha would immediately be the number one player in that division, by far. It's not even close. She would come in with more name recognition than anybody else in that division. She would elevate that division. If Tony Khan booked her the right way, and that's always been a question mark when it comes to the AEW women's division, Sasha and Saraya, Sasha and Britt Baker, Sasha and Jamie Hayter, Toni Storm, Chris Statlander, Jade, I mean, there are plenty of fresh faces for her to work with. But WWE does a better job of featuring their women and giving them television time than AEW does. How many segments does WWE devote to the women on Raw every Monday night? How many times have they given the women the main event spot on that show? If you are a fan of women's wrestling, and maybe you don't watch Joshi, but you watch WWE and you watch AEW, you cannot objectively say that AEW devotes more screen time to the women than WWE does. They don't. Now, to be fair, WWE has more screen time than AEW does. WWE has 5 hours every week between Monday and Friday, not counting NXT. AEW has three. But if that's something that Sasha cares about, if that's important to her, and we know it is, because she's talked about it. When they won the women's tag team titles earlier this year, her and Naomi, right? And they're talking about wanting to, you know, help the titles and help the division. This is the sort of thing that she has said that she does care about. So if that's something that is important to her, then she would have to decide, do I go back to WWE under Triple H now, not Vince McMahon, it's under new management. We're in a totally new world now. Imagine a month where Sasha Banks shows up at Wrestle Kingdom on January 4th, wrestles Kairi on January 21st, and then shows up in the Royal Rumble match 1 week later. That would be insane. We live in a wrestling world now where that is possible. Does she go back to WWE and work with the same people that she has already worked with for years? Becky Lynch, Bianca Belair, Bayley, Charlotte Flair, Ronda Rousey. These are all people that Sasha has already worked with. In some cases, multiple times. Or does she take a chance on herself and work anywhere that she wants with whoever she wants and she can call her own shots? In AEW, or a place like Stardom, she would have an endless supply of new faces to work with. And in a place like AEW, maybe take it as a challenge to where maybe she can come in and help elevate that division to a place that it hasn't been before. Maybe if Tony Khan can get Sasha Banks, he'll feel incentivized to level up that women's division. But what does she want to do? Only she can answer that question. WWE is allowing Shinsuke Nakamura to work a match with the Great Muda on the Noah show on New Year's Day. Could they be letting her show up at the Tokyo Dome? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Sasha Banks has been off WWE television for 7 months. You think they're going to let New Japan Pro Wrestling get dibs on her first appearance back before they do? Especially if they have control over the situation. Yeah, we'll give it to New Japan first. Yeah, right. It sounds to me like legally, she is going to be free and clear in a few weeks to do whatever the hell she wants. But before all of that, she's going to be on a charity stream this Wednesday that Bayley is hosting on Instagram Live to benefit Family Giving Tree, which is a nonprofit that grants wishes for kids in the Bay Area. That is where Sasha will be this week. Here's my prediction. After a quiet 7 months, 2023 is going to be a career-defining year for Sasha Banks, under whatever name she goes by. John Cena is on his way back to WWE. They gave the scoop to Variety, who announced that Cena will be appearing on the final SmackDown of the year, December 30th in Tampa, which is where he lives. According to an individual with knowledge of the situation, more announcements are planned for the episode in the coming weeks. This is going to be Cena's second appearance on TV this year. The last time we saw him was on Raw back in June. That was for his John Cena 20th anniversary celebration. The last time that Cena would ever appear on a Vince McMahon-produced show. The last time that we saw Cena in the ring, you'd have to go back to last year. That was SummerSlam last year against Roman Reigns. He worked a dark match a few weeks after that at Madison Square Garden. But we are getting into WrestleMania season, so we're going to start hearing stuff like this. We're going to have people making appearances on TV. And remember, Logan Paul said that he texted Triple H about a match with John Cena at WrestleMania. He did not tear his ACL, so he should be able to make it back in time for Mania. Per the Observer, though, there is a question regarding Cena's availability for Mania, or at least to promote whatever he may be doing at the show, as he is scheduled to be in Australia starting in February for 8 weeks, filming the movie Ricky Stenicki, which is an R-rated comedy starring Zac Efron. I looked up the synopsis on this movie. When three teens pull a prank and burn down a house in their neighborhood, they create a fake person to take the blame. Ricky Stenicki. He did it. 20 years later, we see that they have been using this alibi to get out of every uncomfortable situation in life. When their wives force them to set up a meeting with Stanicky, they hire a washed-up, self-destructive actor to bring Ricky to life. So they didn't say what role Cena is playing in the movie. That sounds like a perfect role for him, though. I would guess that Cena is playing Ricky, but we don't know. But when Cena showed up on Raw back in June, he said that he didn't know when he would be back in the ring again. He said that it would happen. He just didn't know when. And then he said, it won't just be one. If he's on that SmackDown to start the build for a WrestleMania match, and if he's going to be down under for 2 months, that doesn't sound very encouraging. But if he is, maybe he declares himself for the Royal Rumble match. Maybe that's why he's showing up on December 30th. He's going to declare himself for the Royal Rumble match. If he's not filming until February, he can be in the Rumble. I don't know what his schedule is in January, but if he's not filming a movie until February, it stands to reason that he would be available for the Royal Rumble. And then whoever he's working with at WrestleMania can be the one to eliminate him from the Rumble. Whether that's Logan Paul, and that may be cutting it close on his recovery. I don't know if he'll be cleared in time for the Rumble. It could be Logan Paul, or it could be Austin Theory. Remember, he and John Cena had that backstage interaction on Raw the last time we saw Cena on Raw. And there was talk of doing Cena against Theory this year at SummerSlam, but it never materialized. I think if he works Mania, it's one of those two names. It's either going to be Logan Paul or Austin Theory that he gets into the ring with. Start the build at the Royal Rumble. Then he goes away to film his movie. He comes back in time for the pay-per-view. But if he's not going to be able to show up live for the build to Mania, it begs the question, though. If he's not going to be around for any of it, is it even worth it? We're talking potentially about The Rock being on, WrestleMania this year. We're talking about Stone Cold Steve Austin possibly coming back for another match at WrestleMania. And now we're talking about John Cena. I don't have a problem with them getting Mania matches, but some of these fucking guys have to actually be on the shows leading up to WrestleMania to promote their match. We can't just have these guys being absentee stars. So if you're going to have two of them or three of them, on the WrestleMania card this year, at least one of them has to make a few appearances on TV, live and in person, leading into the show. Now, on the subject of WrestleMania, according to this week's Wrestling Observer, one of the ideas being talked about internally in WWE is for Roman Reigns to wrestle both nights in Los Angeles, with the working ideas being matches with Dwayne Johnson on one night and Cody Rhodes on the other. Exactly the idea that I pitched on the podcast last week. Now, this is far from confirmed, but that is said to be the working idea. They still don't even know if Rock will be there. He's got another month to let them know before they have to lock in their plans. And in addition to whatever movie stuff The Rock may be doing, he's got a football league to launch early next year. February 18th, that's the expected start date for the new XFL season. So he's got his hands full. Meltzer says that there is also talk of splitting the titles after WrestleMania so that Raw has its own champion again. The title should have been split no later than Survivor Series, but now it's too late. It's too late for WrestleMania now. So after WrestleMania, if there's a draft, that would be the next best time to do it. Running Roman Reigns on two nights can work in this way. If they get Rock in for a match with Roman Reigns, you do that match on night one. It doesn't even need to be a championship match. That reward should go to the winner of the Royal Rumble, which should be Cody Rhodes. Not unlike when Triple H made his big return from injury in 2002. He won the Royal Rumble and he went on to WrestleMania. You do the same thing with Cody Rhodes. But if you do Rock and Roman on night one with Roman winning, you come back on night two with Roman defending against Cody. And when the bloodline inevitably gets involved, right, it's just he can't overcome these odds. Rock comes back out to even the odds and fight off the bloodline. That makes it a fair fight. Cody beats Roman. Steve Austin headlined night one of WrestleMania this year. He came back out again on night two. So if The Rock is there on night one, I can't imagine he doesn't show up to do something on night two. Cody is a member of the Raw roster. The WWE title is what Cody is after. Right? That's the championship his father just had snatched away from him. That's the story he told when he debuted, when he came back and he was on Monday Night Raw earlier this year. The WWE title is the one that he's after. So when they split the titles after WrestleMania, the Universal title goes back to SmackDown and they crown a new champion in a tournament. And there you go. Now something is going on with Asuka They had two triple threat matches on Raw last Monday to see which two women would wrestle on Raw tomorrow night, with the winner of that match getting a Raw Women's Championship match, probably at the Royal Rumble, against Bianca Belair. Bayley won one of the matches over Asuka and Rhea Ripley. She pinned Asuka. Alexa Bliss won the other one over Becky Lynch and Nikki Cross. I assume Alexa Bliss is the one who is going to get the next shot, because Bianca has already beaten Bayley a few times. I have no desire to see this again. Rhea Ripley attacked Asuka after the match was over and left her laying with the riptide. The next day, Asuka went on Twitter and she posted a clip from the match and said, "I think everyone should choose someone other than me." And then she posted, "I don't want respect. I have never wanted to be respected. I don't care about that. I'm going to listen to the new Metallica song and go to bed." She then proceeded to post six different times with six different photos of herself from her days in Japan as Kana with the clown makeup. These did not look to be new photos. I think they were old photos. In one of the tweets, she said, "The world is full of shit," which is true. In another one, she said, "Goodbye, cruel world." In another one, she included a video of her applying the makeup with lyrics in the tweet that were captioned that said, "Cast out forever, be abandoned forever, be shattered forever, all bonds of nature. Disowned may you be forever, abandoned may you be forever, destroyed be forever, all the bonds of nature." I'm ready for Kana the Murder Clown to come to WWE. It's basically her more aggressive alter ego. It's like Dark Asuka, basically. You know, Pentagon Dark and Lucha Underground, that's basically what Kana would be relative to the Asuka that we have seen in WWE. I hope Triple H lets her do it. She was on the winning side at War Games, but since she came back from her injury a few months ago, she really hasn't had any direction. You know, this transformation could be just what she needs. Right now, it's just her posting some photos on Twitter, but I would love to see this version of Asuka on television. A couple of other WWE notes real quick here. Bill Goldberg was on ESPN Radio with Max Kellerman, and he confirmed that he will wrestle again at some point. He didn't specifically say it would be WWE, but he did say that he will wrestle again at some point. He said he does not want to go out losing to Roman Reigns, which was the last time that we saw him. He lost to Roman at Elimination Chamber in Saudi Arabia. I say fine. Let him take some chops and lose to Walter. There's no shame in going out that way. And speaking of Walter, WWE is returning to Madison Square Garden for their annual post-Christmas house show on December 26th, advertising the return of Bray Wyatt to Madison Square Garden for the first time in over 3 years. They don't say what he'll be doing, probably talking to himself again. Plus an 8-man tag with Drew McIntyre, Sheamus, Kevin Owens, and Braun Strowman against Sami Zayn, Solo Sikoa, and The Usos. Madison Square Garden, not even worthy of Roman Reigns. And a fatal 5-way ladder match for the Intercontinental title with Gunther defending against Shinsuke Nakamura, Ricochet, Kofi Kingston, and Santos Escobar. That is a random match. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We have all had car troubles, computer problems, something breaks down or it isn't working the right way, and it can be a real pain in the butt trying to figure out how to fix it. Life doesn't always come with a user manual, even when these things do come with one. I always misplace them. I can't find where they are. Therapists are trained to help you figure out what's causing your problems, making therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of you that there is. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient, secure, and accessible anywhere, 100% online. Therapy can bring a host of benefits, like learning important coping skills, self-empowerment, and dealing with trauma. Or maybe it's something you'd consider small that's been bothering you and you don't know how to deal with it. When it's happening to you, though, it never feels small. Trust me. I've been there myself. Everyone deserves to feel their best. BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. It's the world's largest therapy service, having matched millions of people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists. It has the benefits of in-person therapy, but it's more convenient and more affordable, which I know can be a big sticking point for people these days. Just fill out a short questionnaire to match with a therapist. If you try it and you don't think things are working out, it's easy to switch to a different therapist that you do feel comfortable with. So if you're feeling stuck, get unstuck with BetterHelp. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's betterhelp.com/solomonster. I've got some news here that should be of great interest to Tony Khan heading into the new year, and a year where AEW is going to be negotiating its next television rights deal. The bloodletting and the restructuring continues at Warner Brothers Discovery, which is the parent company of TNT and TBS, AEW's television home for Dynamite and Rampage. Kathleen Finch, the chairman and chief content officer for their U.S. networks, announced in a memo to staff on Friday morning that the heads of just about every one of their cable networks are leaving the company, including Nancy Daniels, who had been overseeing channels like TNT, TBS, and Discovery, and Jane Lattman, who had been overseeing the Food Network and HGTV. In the memo, she wrote, "I am announcing a reorganization today that will ultimately enable our business to run more effectively and collaboratively across all the brands and business functions while maintaining our robust culture of content creation and powerful storytelling. Unfortunately, the changes required will include the elimination of some positions within our content teams and some of the longtime leaders who have been a big part of the company for many years." Also leaving are Matthew Butler, who had been overseeing Travel Channel, and Scott Lewers is leaving as well. Moving forward, Jason Sarlanis will be overseeing programming at TBS, TNT, and True TV. Nancy Daniels had been with the company for many years before the merger and had taken over content oversight for the Turner Networks in May of this year and was responsible for launching the popular 90 Day Fiancé franchise. If you want to know who to blame, she's the one. And it just goes to show you, you know, I mean, I may not like it, but obviously it's very successful. It just goes to show you that nobody is safe. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter how long you've been there for. It doesn't matter how much money you've made for them. Everybody is expendable. That's how these things work at these companies, these big media companies and these networks. Nobody is safe. This is, I want to say, at least the second time now, maybe third, that there have been leaders here that Tony Khan has worked with, leaders at the head of these networks that have been shit-canned and have been replaced by somebody else. I think this might be the third time now. Tony Khan had praised Daniels and Scott Lewers only a few months ago in October, saying they offered tremendous support to him and that they've integrated us into the new company and given us the opportunity to be involved in their most valuable intellectual property and weave it into AEW. It is really exciting. Those integrations he's talking about included the themed episodes around Shark Week and the House of the Dragon launch on HBO. He also talked up Daniels at the post Double or Nothing media scrum in May. At the time, he said, "I feel really good about Warner Brothers Discovery to have such strong management. Nancy Daniels, such a strong leader. She was really cool. I flew out to LA and back to meet Nancy Daniels along with her team. It was some familiar faces and also some new faces. It was really exciting. It was my first time at Discovery. What a great thing we have." All right, everything was kumbaya back then, and now, gone. We've been through this a few times already. Tony Khan has made inroads with these executives. He's formed these relationships and these friendships, only for those people to be fired and replaced by somebody else. Warner Brothers Discovery has said, or has been said, to be very happy with AEW's ratings. And we talk about how they've been down a bit lately. Rampage has been down a lot, but, you know, Dynamite's been down, but then there'll be a week where they pop back up. It's very seesaw, but the numbers have been sort of trending downward lately. We talk about that, but they seem pretty happy with the numbers, which at the end of the day is all that matters. If Warner Brothers Discovery is happy with the numbers that AEW is doing, at least on Wednesdays, then, you know, that's the most important thing. I don't think this is going to have any kind of immediate impact on them or anything like that. We have no idea the longer-term impact, though, that there might be here. It might mean nothing. AEW still produces some of the biggest numbers on their channels. But the bigger issue, all of the chaos coming out of this merger and the cost-cutting, is not ideal for a company that is hoping to get a significant rights increase next year for their shows. I'm sure Tony Khan's first choice would be to stay with Warner and Discovery and to triple the amount of money that they're paying him right now. Warner does not run AEW. Tony Khan does. So no matter what happens at Warner Brothers Discovery, it's not like they own the company, they're going to kill AEW and shut the company down. Ultimately, that's Tony Khan's decision. If something were to happen, they could just end up going somewhere else. But that television money is the lifeblood of that company, and without it, they would be in a lot of trouble. Which is why stories like this are worth mentioning, and why I'm bringing this up. And it's not over yet. They've said that they expect thousands of more employees to be cut by the end of 2024. So I guarantee you, he can put on a happy face publicly, but this is a story that Tony Khan is paying very close attention to and is going to have to pay very close attention to as we go into what is going to end up being, in a lot of ways, I think, a make-or-break year for AEW. This is a very important year coming up. These are not the kind of stories that he wants to be hearing about. Now, Tony Khan hosted a Final Battle media call on Wednesday, and he spoke publicly for the first time about William Regal leaving AEW and confirming that he will be returning to WWE. Regal is going to be starting his new position with WWE the first week of the new year. This is what we know, right? PW Insider was the first to report that. He'll be starting with them the first week of January. It's going to be a behind-the-scenes coaching role. He will not have an on-camera role, since that was one of the conditions of his release, that he not be allowed to appear on television at least for the next year. And he is also ending his podcast that he started earlier this year. So that podcast is no more, at least with him on there. That podcast is no more. Before I did the show last week, I saw what EC3 said about Regal. And that when he went over to AEW, the quote-unquote word was, I immediately regret this decision, and there's very much a maturity issue here within management. I'm sorry, I'm going to need more than EC3 on a podcast with Vince Russo to give me the scoop on what is going on in the mind of William Regal. So I didn't mention it. Justin Labar of Wrestling Inc. then tweeted last Sunday, what I'm picking up is Regal is done with AEW, back to WWE soon. Close with Triple H, but also his wisdom and coaching not appreciated or received the way that you would think by some in the AEW locker room who feel they have six-figure multi-year deals and Regal's advice is behind the times or beneath them. So that was Labar talking about what his kind of view of the situation was. Brian Pillman Jr., who works for AEW, chimed in on the thread and said, this is not entirely true. There are several of us, myself included, who spent multiple hours before TV working with Regal and learning from him. Should there have been more? Maybe. But he and Danielson always had a solid audience around the ring before TV. Labar then said, Brian, I'm glad you're speaking out because the biggest thing of what I said is some. If you or any others were picking his brain, good on you and best of luck. And Pillman responded, I know you said some, I just didn't want the narrative to be that he was just standing there preaching to the air. Some days there would be 10 guys out there soaking it all in. Some days it would just be me and Wheeler and Lee. I didn't mind when his attention wasn't spread as thin. So context is important here, because to hear others talk about it, you would think that Regal was just standing there talking to himself and pulling a Bray Wyatt. There were people that took his advice and listened to him. Now, I can believe that there are others there, bigger stars than Brian Pillman Jr., who think that they don't need to take advice from anybody. They think that their shit doesn't stink and it smells like lavender. Hangman Page made that stupid comment over the summer about feeling like he doesn't need to take advice, that he was part of a movement that created this entire company and I was a world champion, so I don't know that I need to take advice from veterans that work, you know, behind the scenes. He said he takes more pride in the trial and error of trying things on his own to see what works and what doesn't. And hey, that's fine. But it was also a very stupid, tone-deaf thing for him to say. So I don't doubt that there may be some of that going on in AEW. But, you know, we had BJ Bethel on SEScoops.com said that he spoke with a source who refuted the claims made by EC3, who described them as completely inaccurate. He said, I can't believe this. This is what the source told him. I can't believe this is a story. It's complete bullshit. There was never some schedule that you had to be down at the ring and people blew it off. And Regal was never going to flat out tell someone that they had to come to the ring so he could coach them. Regal would work with somebody, people would go down and show up. A lot of people took advantage of it. Other vets do it all the time. It's always the younger women and men. Sometimes someone would work with somebody one-on-one, other times there would be quite a few people down there. It was totally informal. And then another source said Regal would even sit in the stands sometimes with guys and talk about the fans' point of view, or the point of view of watching on TV. He would tell you about making sure to know how you are looking at the fans when you come to the ring, or how you would look on TV. He said, make sure you always are really nice to the camera guys. They're the ones who make you look good. So that's the other side of the story, which I think is important to get out there. What Regal thought of Tony Khan and AEW management, only he knows. But Tony Khan was very accommodating when it came to his request to leave. And he revealed that his mother, Tony Khan's mother, suffered a stroke a few days before the Grand Slam show in September, which made that period even more stressful for him because it was coming off the fallout from the Brawl Out scrum and all the creative plans that had to be changed as a result. CM Punk got hurt, he went away, the Elite were suspended, everything had to change, right? So then his mother suffered a second stroke and needed an operation for a spot that they found on her heart, which if not fixed, could cause more strokes in the future. And he was at home celebrating his 40th birthday with his parents when he got a phone call from their chief legal officer that Regal had approached her about wanting to leave the company. And the reason he gave was that he has a son, which is Charlie Dempsey, who works in NXT, who, if you saw him, you would know right away that was William Regal's son. There's no doubt. There's no doubt where that DNA comes from. And he wanted to be there to help in his development. And his contract gave AEW the right to pick up the option to renew at the end of the year, and he asked them, please don't renew it. So Tony said he really had to think about it because Regal was an important part of their storylines. And he spoke to Regal on the phone. He was sitting on a park bench outside the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville while his mother was sleeping inside. And he said that he had a really good, you know, conversation with him. He said Regal had really good intentions for wanting to go back and be with his son. And in that moment, with his own mother going through what she was going through, he didn't want to be the one to stand between him and his son. In October, he sat down with Regal in Jacksonville. They sat down for 90 minutes after Rampage, that they did a Rampage show in Jacksonville. And he said that he would make some sacrifices to give Regal what he wanted. He said Regal is still with them through the holidays. He's not officially gone yet. And that he will not be able to facilitate every family reunion, but AEW is a family first company and he wanted to make this work. And then later on, when he was asked about people like Malakai Black and Andrade and Buddy Matthews, who have wives and girlfriends working in WWE, you know, would you allow any of them to go back if they asked? He said those are different situations because with Regal, he's not going to be allowed to appear on television. Obviously, if any of those guys went back to WWE, they're not going back as a coach. They would be going back as talent. So, yes, those are very different situations. Now, as far as Tony Khan's mother is concerned, she seems to be doing better. That's very good to hear. You know, Tony Khan and I are the same age. His birthday is 4 days after mine. And anybody who's listened to this podcast for a long period of time, you know the situation with my mother. I documented it here on the podcast as it was happening. And I lost my mom. It's going to be 5 years in March, which I can't believe. But I have a lot of sympathy and empathy, you know, for what he probably was going through and how stressful of an experience that was. It sucks. I don't wish that on anybody. And obviously nobody knew what was going on because he kept that very close to the vest. So it sucks that she got sick. It's good that she seems to be doing better. But I can sympathize. I can understand with him being in a situation where he had all of this shit going on back in September. Right? And couldn't talk about any of it and was trying to sort through all of that and figure out new creative directions because he lost four of his top stars in one fell swoop. Punk, Nick Jackson, Matt Jackson, Kenny Omega all went away when he had big plans for them heading into Full Gear. So it's a terrible situation for anybody to be in. I'm sure some people listening to this right now have been down that same road. But thankfully, she seems to be doing better. But it hit home for me in a way that maybe it didn't for most, just because I've been there myself and being the same age as him and there's a lot of similarities there, and it sucks, but thankfully she's doing better. Now, last Sunday, I mentioned Regal's son on the podcast, and I mentioned family as being one of the reasons why I think Regal may have wanted to go back to WWE, and now we come to find out that's exactly what he told Tony Khan. Now, did he have other reasons? Is he lying? Did he have other intentions? I don't know. It's possible. He probably did. I think the moment Triple H took over for Vince McMahon, he was probably thinking about going back. I don't know if he had his mind made up, but when Triple H took over as the head of creative and Vince McMahon went away, I'm sure that that's exactly what Regal was thinking in his mind, about going back to work for Triple H, which is probably where he thought he would always be until the day he retired or the day he died, is doing what he was doing in NXT and working for Triple H, who's one of his best friends. Those two have been close for a very long time. And I said I could see Regal going back to WWE and being to Triple H what Pat Patterson was to Vince McMahon, his right-hand man. As things stand, it's a conditional release. The compromise was that he can coach, but he cannot appear on television for the next year, which would mean no War Games proclamations from him for Survivor Series next year if they bring back the War Games matches. Speaking of War Games, Tony said that he was surprised by Triple H's War Games tweet, which was a video compilation of all the times Regal said War Games on NXT, and he didn't feel it was in the spirit of AEW accommodating Regal's request. He shouldn't be surprised. I don't know why he is. WWE does not care about Tony Khan's feelings. They have shown that before time and time again. WWE does not care about your feelings. I know he takes these things very personally. I wish he wouldn't. But it's what they do. He was angry about them running two shows the same weekend as All Out. He took that as a personal offense. He should have expected it. I don't know why he continues to be surprised by these things. And also, the reality is, it was old footage that they owned. It was a tweet that Triple H put up. It wasn't even that nefarious. Did he have other intentions in doing it? Yes, I'm sure he did. But it was old footage that they owned. They can do whatever they want with it. On Dynamite, they tried to tie things up in a bow as neatly as possible by having William Regal explain his rationale for doing what he did. Why did he do what he did when he turned on Jon Moxley at Full Gear? Tony Schiavone was in the ring. There was a tag team match with Claudio and Wheeler Yuta against Daniel Garcia and Jake Hager. And after the match, Tony got in the ring and he said, I have something I want to show you guys. Because he had all the members, the remaining members of the Blackpool Combat Club were in the ring. Moxley was there, Claudio was there, Wheeler was there. And he said, look, I've been friends with William Regal for over 25 years. He's a dear personal friend of mine. And I had an opportunity to do an interview with him a few weeks ago. And I think you guys ought to see what we recorded. Now, this was after Full Gear, but before MJF bashed him in the back of the head with the brass knucks. Right. So before they did the injury angle with Regal, Regal had a sense. He had a premonition that something bad might happen. And he wanted to take the time to explain things before anything bad happened. He said, people will only see this interview if something bad happens to me, and you're always expecting something bad to happen. He took exception to what MJF did to Tony Schiavone when he put his hands on him a few months ago. And, you know, he's been going around angry about old emails and stuff. So he gave MJF what he wanted. Now he's the world champion, but now everybody is going to be chasing after him. He's got a target on his back. And he realized several months ago that the three main members of the Blackpool Combat Club, Bryan Danielson was not there on Wednesday. They said he was at the hospital with Regal. But he said in this interview here that the three main members of the Blackpool Combat Club, that being Moxley, Danielson, and Claudio, he realized that they don't need him around anymore. But he also knew that if he wanted to leave, they wouldn't let him go. He needed to show them why they don't need him and why they can teach young Wheeler to be the best in the world. He said, you have to lead by example, though. Hopefully Jon Moxley understands, since he's a calculating man like him. The reason he did what he did at Full Gear was to teach the final thing he could ever teach, which is always stay one step ahead and always keep eyes in the back of your head. And then he said he is Blackpool Combat Club until the day he dies. It was Regal's choice to leave AEW. Tony Khan gave him what he wanted. He tried to come up with some sort of explanation for things to tie things up on his way out. I thought it was as good as could be expected, the circumstances being what they were. Was it a great explanation? No. Did William Regal, to teach them a lesson, have to cost Jon Moxley the championship? No. And Jon Moxley looked confused in the ring after hearing this explanation, and then he just quickly moved on from it. But I at least appreciate them trying to tie up loose ends. I'm not going to beat him up over this. Regal put everybody over that he could on the way out. He put over MJF, and he did the injury angle. He laid down for him. He went out on a stretcher. He put over the Blackpool Combat Club right down to Wheeler Yuta. And I'm going to miss seeing him on television now for the next year. One thing I do agree with that EC3 said is that Regal is too valuable not to be in a developmental system. He never should have been fired from that developmental system in the first place. Moxley, by the way, he worked that show on Wednesday sick. He and Renee both were very sick. She missed the show on Wednesday. He flew in for it, though, because he knew they needed him for the Regal stuff. On his birthday, no less. Wednesday was his 37th birthday. And when he got there, they asked him to work a match against Konosuke Takeshita for the Rampage taping, which I watched. That match was better than anything on SmackDown this week. I have yet to see a bad Takeshita match. He is a tremendous talent. I hope AEW realizes they have something very special in him. But that was a very good match on Friday night. But Jon Moxley, putting in the work. Another reason why he is the MVP of this company in 2022. There was another segment that was fantastic on the show on Wednesday. I thought it was actually an excellent episode of Dynamite on the whole this week. Ricky Starks and MJF. What did I say coming into that show on Wednesday? Because Ricky Starks was announced for this Dynamite Diamond Ring Battle Royal. And I said, if Tony Khan does not put a live microphone in Ricky Starks' hand and MJF's hand on this final week before their match at Winter is Coming, he is out of his mind. Thankfully, he did put microphones in their hands on Wednesday. And what we got was fantastic. MJF was his usual self. He went after Ricky verbally. He compared him to The Rock. He called him Discount Dwayne. He called him The Pebble. All of these things, which not everybody would be able to recover from that. And I was kind of worried as he was saying this, because there is some truth to that when I look at Ricky Starks. And I felt that way when I first saw him on NWA Power. There's a little bit of Rock in his swagger. Not that he's copying off of him. Maybe he doesn't even intend for it, but there's definitely some of that there. And if you call attention to that on TV and you call him The Pebble and people were laughing in the crowd, it's like, ah, shit, right? I mean, not everybody would be able to recover from that. But as soon as Starks had his chance to respond to what MJF was saying and called him MaxiPad, from that point forward, he had the crowd in the palm of his hand. When that segment was over, nobody was talking about The Rock. Nobody was thinking about The Pebble. They were talking about, holy shit, Ricky Starks just smoked this fucking guy on the microphone. And they were thinking that this is a guy who can one day be a world champion in AEW. That was a fucking great segment. It was the best promo of Ricky Starks' life. But he is not going to win the AEW World Championship this Wednesday. He does, however, by virtue of his Battle Royal win, have the opportunity to challenge for the Dynamite Diamond Ring. As far as I know, the match between them on Wednesday at Winter is Coming is now for both the AEW World title and the Dynamite Diamond Ring. Both of them being on the line in the same match, when the stipulation for the Battle Royal was that the winner could basically declare the when and where they want to challenge MJF for the Diamond Ring. The fact that both of these things are up for grabs in the same match doesn't seem to make much sense, unless there is some sort of disputed finish that they do. If it's for the championship only, they could have MJF cheat to win, because that's what he does. Starks then wrestles him a different week. He picks the date and time to wrestle him for the Diamond Ring, and he wins. And then later, Ricky can say, well, I beat you once for this ring. I want a rematch for the title. And that gets you to the third match. It gives them a reason to complete the trilogy of the series. Otherwise, the ring has outlived its usefulness. I just don't see the need for it. But I am puzzled by them putting both things on the line in the same match. Other news and notes. WWE Hall of Famer Barry Windham was hospitalized in intensive care after suffering a massive heart attack while traveling through the Atlanta airport. Not this past Friday, but the Friday before. He went into cardiac arrest. He underwent emergency surgery to save his life. his niece Mika, who is the sister of Bray Wyatt and Bo Dallas, posted on a GoFundMe page that was set up for him that, as a family, we are impatiently waiting to hear that he will be okay, but as of now, the future is uncertain. And she wrote that Barry has no health insurance and he's been limited with work due to injuries he suffered during his career. On Friday morning, Mika posted that her uncle is now stabilized and out of the ICU. He's talking, he's able to stand up, all of which is great news. On Friday night, Bray Wyatt broke character. He posted a very personal message about his uncle on Instagram, and we got more details about what happened. This is what he had to say. Normally, I keep a lot of my outside life separate from anything I do on here or in the ring. I just wanted to let everybody know I am incredibly thankful for the support and the love I've received since I've been back and throughout my career. Wrestling has been a part of my life always. When I was a kid, I looked at my dad and my uncles and my grandfather, who were all professional wrestlers. I looked at them like they were Greek gods, like they couldn't feel pain, they were immortal, and they'd always be just like that. As we get older, and I become a man myself, you start to understand that's just not the case. Nothing is forever. This week, my uncle Barry Windham had a massive heart failure in Atlanta, and he went down. And he did not have a pulse for 10 to 20 minutes. He was away. He was gone. I wanted to thank one specific man, Michael Todd Lalick, who was there, a random citizen, who gave him CPR for that entire time before everybody else could get to the EMTs over to him, and he stayed with him, and he's the reason why we still have Barry. He is alive, he is with us. Barry Windham has given his life to his profession. His whole life has been about this, just like mine. You put everything into it, and I just wanted to share that I am incredibly thankful to have him back. My sister set up a GoFundMe in his name. No one is obligated to share anything, but if you could, that would be incredibly helpful. And take it from me. Sometimes when you're someone like that, it's incredibly powerful to remind them that they mean a lot to a lot of people. I hope everyone out there is hearing this. I hope you take this from me. Be good to the ones you love. Always remind them about that, how much they mean to you, because nothing is forever. Thank you for everything. To have no pulse for 20 minutes is very scary. And I'm glad that it sounds like Barry is doing better. I'm sure he's got a long road ahead. Windham was a member of the best version of the Four Horsemen. That's the version that usually gets the most praise. There's a reason for that. Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Barry Windham, and J.J. Dillon. That's the version that was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame 10 years ago. One of the best wrestlers in the business back in his heyday. And keeping with the health theme, MLW star Richard Holiday, who once held the MLW tag team titles with MJF, only 30 years old, announced in a Sports Illustrated story this week that he has not wrestled a match since June after being diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. He had turned on his best friend at the time, MLW champion Alex Hammerstone. He was starting to take off as a heel when he got the diagnosis. He said he felt off. When he wrestled Hammerstone in June, he was taking DayQuil just to get through the day. At first, he thought he had some sort of virus or a stomach bug. After the match, his condition got worse. He ended up in the emergency room in July. His condition, I guess, just continued to get worse. His iron and his hemoglobin were dangerously low. They thought he was anemic. When he wasn't improving, he was eventually checked in September for lymphoma, and those tests confirmed that it was Hodgkin's lymphoma. And not just lymphoma, it was stage 4 lymphoma, which is about the worst news you could get. He requested to immediately begin chemotherapy. He's already halfway through his 12 rounds of chemo. He says he's going to come out of this stronger to let people know that they can beat this also. He's thinking every day about his return to the ring, and his goal right now is to be declared cancer-free after his last treatment and then ring their celebratory bell. A lot of these places, for those who don't know, when you're done with your chemo or you're done with your radiation, they have a bell in the hallway. So when you're done, your final treatment is over, you go and everybody crowds around and you ring the bell and it's like a big happy occasion. So he's planning, he says, to ring that bell so hard that he'll break it and he'll be more than happy to buy them a new one. So best wishes to him. You know, to be diagnosed with stage 4 anything, especially at 30 years old, is horrifying. Let alone when your career is really first starting to take off. I hope he gets to ring that bell. Hacksaw Jim Duggan rang the bell after he finished his last radiation treatment in August for prostate cancer. I hope he gets to do it too and makes it a part of his comeback story. This week was the final episode of Tales from the Territories for Season 1. I don't know if there will be a Season 2, but I enjoyed this first season, and they closed it out with Cowboy Bill Watts' Mid-South Wrestling. For the round table, they got Jim Ross, who worked very closely with the Cowboy and was his lead play-by-play announcer, Ted DiBiase, who had a big heel turn there and a memorable feud with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Jake the Snake Roberts, and Michael P.S. Hayes. It was something watching Jake light up a cigarette when, up until a few months ago, he was walking around with an oxygen tank for his COPD. But when you've been smoking since you're 17 years old, I guess old habits die hard. For those who don't know, Mid-South was a territory that encompassed Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And it was known for blood. Actually, most of these territories, it seems, were known for blood. Mid-South was no different, right? Red equals green. That was the old mantra. Watts was known for being very strict about heels and baby faces not traveling together or being seen together in public, keeping kayfabe. If a civilian picked a fight with you at a bar, you better win the fight. If you didn't, you'd be out of a job. Watts pushed the Junkyard Dog as his top babyface there for years. And he probably had a solid 5-year run as the top draw there before Vince McMahon snatched him up. And by then, he wasn't the performer that he was in Mid-South. Even at the tail end of his time in Mid-South, probably the last year or so that he was in Mid-South, you know, he had put on a lot of weight and he just wasn't the performer that he used to be. But Watts pushed JYD with the idea that as a black man, you know, being pushed as strong as he was, he would draw a huge audience of black fans for his promotion. Not only did he draw black fans, he drew tons of white fans for JYD also. JYD was super over. You know, a lot of them back then probably would not have gotten behind too many black stars. They went nuts for JYD. That guy was treated like a god down there. And I think he was pulling in something like $12,000 a week at his peak, which was unheard of back then, except for maybe only the biggest names in the business. And then he pissed it all away on drugs. He was a notorious cocaine user. A lot of wrestlers were back then, but him maybe more than most. As far back as I think 82 or 83, as big of a star as he was, he would be spotted in the Louisiana projects or Mississippi, I forget which. And you can imagine what he was doing there. It got really bad. And he lost his physique. He put on so much weight at the end of his Mid-South run. And in WWE, he was still popular. But he just wasn't the same. Look, I had these pictures I still have when I was a kid. And on the wall, I mean, I was, you know, I was a big Hulk Hogan fan, Macho Man and all that. But on the wall in one of the photos, I had a JYD poster on the wall. Like, JYD was fucking big even then. You know, in WWF, if you were a young wrestling fan. But compared to how he was previously, he just wasn't the same. And it was even worse years later in WCW. He wrestled Ric Flair and he sucked. He was a shell of himself. It's why Meltzer used to call him the junk food dog in those old observers. And one of the more famous wrestling angles involved JYD and the Fabulous Freebirds. And it was a tag team match in New Orleans with JYD and Buck Robley against the Birds, with the loser getting this magic hair cream rubbed on their head that would make them lose their hair. And the Freebirds win. They're holding Buck to put the cream on his head. JYD jumps in to try to save him. Michael Hayes puts the cream in JYD's eyes instead. And they build it like, oh, was it an accident or not? If you watch the footage, it clearly was not an accident. But that's kind of how the announcers were portraying it. And he sold this like I have never seen him sell before. He's rolling around in the ring in agony. They put a towel over his head to cover his face. You know, he's been blinded by this cream that was meant to go in someone's hair, not in their eyes. And, oh, he may be permanently blind now. And, you know, you may as well have thrown acid at the Pope, the heat that these men got for doing this to the Junkyard Dog. The angle was so great, they did it twice in Georgia years later. Only that time, JYD only got blinded in one eye by the Freebirds. Here it was both eyes. And what really sold it was the fact that Dog's wife at the time was due to give birth to their first child. And they played it up like now he's not even going to be able to see his new daughter. You know, at his house, he would keep the blinds drawn so people wouldn't be able to see inside, that he wasn't really blind. There was one promo where he says, here's my new baby. He's with his wife and his kid. And he's like presenting his you know, family, his new child to the audience. And his wife has to take his hand and kind of guide it to where, you know, she was holding the child because he was pointing in the wrong direction because he couldn't see. So JYD and Hayes, they did big business in cage matches after that when Dog was still blinded. They had one dog collar match in a cage that did 26,000 fans at the Superdome. There's a famous story of a JYD fan jumping the rail at a show and pulling out a gun and aiming it at the Freebirds. And JYD panicked. He didn't know what to do because he was trying to keep kayfabe. And thankfully, the cops tackled the guy. I just love the idea. Like, he didn't know what to do. Like, well, do I save this man's life? Do I save him from getting his brains blown out? Or do I maintain kayfabe? I don't know. Well, he was able to keep kayfabe because thankfully there were cops there to tackle the guy. But in the episode, Hayes tells a story about security finding a guy in the bathroom with a gun, and inside the chamber was a bullet that was engraved with the word Freebird on it. Which, I mean, that just sounds ridiculous to me. I assume that's his telling of the story, of the same story. I don't know that I believe that part, but he did have a gun drawn on him, that I know. My favorite Junkyard Dog story, though, it still has nothing to do with Mid-South, but it's still him borrowing, quote-unquote borrowing, $300 worth of weed from New Jack, and New Jack never getting paid back for it. And then years later, when JYD came to an ECW show, New Jack, he never forgot about the money that was owed to him, and he sucker punched him right in the face. I think Dog got a few shots in on him too. When Dog went out to the ring, because they had some like legends that they were introducing in the ring that night. When he went to the ring, before he went out, they gave him a different shirt. I think he was wearing an ECW shirt. They gave him a different t-shirt to wear because the old one had blood on it. But he went out there and he got the biggest pop of the night of anybody, you know, that they introduced. And then a month later, he was dead. Jim Ross is the one who sort of held court for the episode. They usually have that one person, and clearly they're like, all right, you're going to be the designated person. You're going to be the one to mention, oh, I heard this story. Can you tell us this story? There's always like a designated person. So Jim Ross was the one who, he sort of held court for this episode. And he told a story about Bill Watts making some enemies in his heyday. And one of those people was Jerry Brown, one of the original Hollywood Blondes, who felt like he and his partner should have been making more money, right? A common complaint of many a wrestler from the territory days. And Watts fired him. Now, in other versions of this that I've read, Watts fired him because of his drug problem and alcohol problem. He became unreliable. Well, Brown didn't take too kindly to being fired, and he would sit outside of Watts' home in his car. He was stalking him for hours on end. And one time, he mailed a clock to Watts, showing how easy it would be for him to mail him a bomb if he wanted to. Police were called several times. They never found him with a weapon, so there was nothing they could really do about it. They couldn't charge him with anything. Until one day, with Watts and his family at home, shots were fired into their home, and supposedly they nearly struck Watts' daughter. So, as legend has it, Brown ended up with the barrel of a shotgun in his mouth, and he never bothered Watts or his family again. Now, JR admits he doesn't know if that part happened or not, but knowing Bill Watts the way that he did, he believes that it happened. He said nobody got killed, so that would have to be considered a win for the territory days. And then he told the Leroy McGurk story, another one of my favorites. Although not in as much detail as he has told it before, which is too bad because, you know, it's a great story. But that's why you have me here. I'm here to fill in the gaps for you on these stories. There's only so many stories and details of those stories they can fit, I guess, in 44 minutes. So that's where I come in. Jim Ross, for those who don't know, he drove Leroy McGurk around a lot when he was first starting out in the business. Back in the late 70s, McGurk was a promoter. Before that, he held the NWA junior heavyweight title over 10 years straight, right? He made him the longest reigning male singles champion of all time. And then in 1950, he was involved in a bad car accident where he went flying into the windshield and he smashed his glasses. Pieces of the glass went into his one good eye and it caused him to go blind. He was already blind in the other eye. He had an accident when he was a kid back in the 1920s. So now he's blind in both eyes. So that's the end of his wrestling career. So that's the backstory on Leroy McGurk. Now, he had a daughter named Mike. He wanted a boy. He didn't get a boy, but he still called her Mike, even though she was born Michelle. If you're a longtime WWE fan, you remember a female ring announcer in the early 90s named Mike McGurk. That was Leroy's daughter. And Leroy had a rule back then when he was a promoter that nobody, no wrestler, was to date his daughter. Well, he found out that Ted DiBiase was dating his daughter. And at the time, Leroy was working for Bill Watts, as was JR. His job was to get Leroy to the TV tapings on time. So JR picks him up one day, and Leroy hands him his travel bag, and he says, look inside. Inside the bag, JR finds a .44 Magnum. And JR asks him, he goes, what's with the gun? And Leroy tells him, we're going to kill Ted DiBiase. All right, the royal we. We are going to kill Ted DiBiase. So he had all of this thought out. His plan was to have JR tell DiBiase, hey, Leroy wants you to go to his room. He's got this great idea for you that he wants to talk about. And when DiBiase got to the door, I think this would have been in a hotel, Leroy then would empty the chamber right through the door and hope that one of the bullets hit him because he's fucking blind, right? He's blind and the door is closed, so it's not like he'd be able to see. Now imagine that poor housekeeper if she came to the room at the wrong time, right? That would have been very bad. So JR rightfully is totally freaked out by this. I mean, his boss is going to kill this guy and make him an accomplice to murder. Meanwhile, the gun is on the dashboard. Every time JR makes a left turn, the gun slides to the right. When he makes a right turn, it slides to the left. Like Jake said, don't make any right turns. But what he didn't mention in the episode that he did in his book is that ash from the cigar that Leroy was smoking had landed in Leroy's lap. It landed in his crotch. And he didn't realize it, because he's fucking blind. And it's burning a hole through his pants. And Leroy starts shouting, what the fuck? Right? And JR has no idea what's wrong. He's swerving all over the road, the gun's going everywhere. He pulls over on the side of the road to get out and see what's wrong, and he can see the smoke, but he has no idea where it's coming from. And then Leroy starts shouting, my balls, Jim! My balls! My balls! They're burning, right? So JR starts blowing on his balls, like he's blowing out a birthday cake. It's not working. So now JR is just praying to God that a state trooper doesn't drive by to see him on the side of the road with his head buried in this old man's crotch. So he starts slapping his balls, and eventually the fire gets put out. He gets back in the car. He stops at a service station. He's looking for a payphone. He's got to call Bill Watts and tell him about this murder plot. So he gets Watts on the phone, and Watts just starts laughing hysterically. And he tells JR, okay, he's probably close to passing out from the whiskey that he was drinking. Get to the hotel, put him to bed. I'll get there by the time you guys arrive, and I'll take him off your hands. And that's what he did, and JR never heard another word about it, and the Million Dollar Man's life was spared. And they asked DiBiase at the round table, they said, how much longer did you date his daughter after that? He goes, not much longer. It wasn't much longer after that. Jake talked about his famous run-in at the Superdome with the legendary Muhammad Ali. WrestleMania was not the only wrestling show Ali worked as a guest enforcer in 1985. In June, he was ringside for a match between Jake the Snake and the Snowman, who was their television champion at the time. He was there to back up the Snowman, which, as Michael Hayes noted, was an appropriate nickname for the guy. Jake said for all the wrong reasons, if Jake Roberts is calling you out for having a drug problem, you know you've got issues. So Jake had John Nord, the Berserker, in his corner. Nord was only 5 weeks into the business at that point. They show the footage in the episode of the end of the match, which is on YouTube. Ali gets up on the apron, he starts throwing shots. Nord is bumping his ass off for every punch. Jake, though, he's taking the punches. It's not like he's just standing there, but he's taking the punches. He's kind of selling them, but he doesn't go down. He took one shot, he kind of staggers, but he doesn't go down. He takes a second shot, he staggers, but he doesn't go down. He takes a third shot, he still doesn't go down. But he staggers backwards into the arms of the Snowman, who hits his power slam finish and he pins Jake to retain the title. When Jake got to the back, Bill Watts was furious with him for not selling for Muhammad Ali. And Jake's rationale was, I've got to come back here and work tomorrow in front of these people. Ali doesn't. And Jake says that Ali came up to him in the locker room and he didn't know if he would be mad. And instead, he whispered to Jake, smart man. Like he gets it. You know, he realizes that Jake's got to go back out there the next night and work in front of those same people. And they all agree at the round table that Ali was somebody who got it. He got their business. Yeah, he was a wrestling fan. He understood. Keep in mind all the trash talk that Ali became famous for during his boxing career that made him a big star. He got that from watching pro wrestling. And Fred Blassie. Ali was a huge wrestling fan. He had respect for what they did and he borrowed from them. And they again blame the death of the territories in this episode on Vince McMahon's national expansion, which led to JR telling his famous story of being on the commode when he overheard two promoters plotting to murder Vince McMahon. So this is our second murder plot here of the episode. There was a meeting of NWA promoters in Kansas City. They were going to try to figure out how to stop Vince from growing any bigger. Watts had JR accompany him on the trip with the idea that you might learn something, like his understudy. So they're getting ready to have lunch. There was a break in the meeting, so JR goes off to do his business on the porcelain throne. Now again, this is not an official meeting of NWA promoters. They had those. This was almost like a clandestine meeting. How can we stop Vince, right? So there's a break in the meeting, and JR goes, he's got to go take a shit. All of a sudden, a couple of famous promoters, Hall of Fame men, he did not name who they were, walk into the men's room, oblivious to the fact that there's somebody in one of the stalls. And they start talking about Vince, and one guy says, I could have the motherfucker killed for $700. Why don't we just do that? Now, all of a sudden, JR's feet, they start to slowly elevate up off the floor. Now he's hoping that nobody sees him, right? And he's probably clenching, too. So they wash their hands, and they end up, leaving the room, and he couldn't wait to lower his feet back down to the floor because at that point his stomach was hurting from holding them up there like that. That and probably the bowel full of crap that he was desperately trying to hold in. That's a tough feeling. I've been there before. I can't go in a public bathroom. Not with other people in there. It's just a thing. When I used to still work in the city, I'll tell you a little story here. When I used to work in the city still, right before everybody closed their office, if I wasn't at the office, if I was out at a meeting or I was coming back from one or whatever, I would run halfway around Midtown Manhattan if I had to try to find a bathroom stall if I was that desperate. The best one I ever found was at, of all places, the best, maybe this isn't surprising, but the best one I ever found was at Tiffany's on Fifth Avenue. They had these nice big stalls with doors that came all the way down to the floor. You couldn't see shit that was going on under there. Actually, the nicest bathrooms I've ever been in were at this Mexican restaurant out on Long Island, which I guess makes sense, right? I mean, because at a Mexican restaurant, it's probably Armageddon in there sometimes. Anyway, all these guys on these episodes have talked about, for the past 10 weeks, they've talked about pissing and shitting and vomiting, so I'm allowed to tell my own tales from the territory. Those are my tales from the New York territory. So anyway, Watts ended up rebranding Mid-South as the Universal Wrestling Federation. That he did that as a way to try to not sound so regional. It was his failed way of trying to expand nationally. That's really what it was. You know, JR says the television ratings were still great, but people just weren't buying tickets anymore. He blamed it on the oil industry in the area slowing down and people not having as much money to buy tickets. Watts ended up selling to Crockett. Jim Ross is the one who brokered the deal because Watts didn't even like Crockett and he refused to make the trip to go meet with him. So he sent JR in his place. But the idea was that Crockett would run the UWF as its own separate entity. And stop me if you've heard this before. He would run the UWF as its own separate entity. And they could build to these annual Super Bowl-like shows pitting stars from the two promotions against each other. But much like Vince McMahon buying WCW, they dropped the ball and they didn't do it. And it was that UWF purchase that sped up the demise of Crockett Promotions. And I think within a year, is when Crockett sold to Ted Turner. I mean, he had a lot of other spending issues as well, but that purchase did not help. It hastened the downfall of Crockett Promotions. So Watts never even got all the money that he was owed to him for selling the company. In the end, he got something like 40 cents on the dollar for it. And here we are now, years later, Vince McMahon ended up owning all of the footage, Crockett and Mid-South. So he got the last laugh in the end. I had fun with these shows. I hope you enjoyed these reviews. Dark Side of the Ring is filming right now, so when that comes back, we'll pick up with the reviews again. This Tuesday is the Vince McMahon documentary on Vice, 9 p.m. Eastern. Some of the talking heads they showed in the commercial for it were Bret Hart, Jim Cornette, Vince Russo, Dave Meltzer, and Brian Alvarez. Cornette and Russo, sharing screen time. It's too bad they weren't in the same room. I would pay good money to see that. Let's take some of your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Like our good friend Kevin in Albany. I get the side of people who are against the idea of The Rock winning the Royal Rumble and headlining WrestleMania. There's others on the roster working hard all year long that deserve it, and there are other stories for the main event. But Rock is a star that cannot be compared to anything else. It would provide so much electricity to WWE and wrestling in general for him to appear on TV a few times next year. But kind of how last year they made sure to get Stone Cold on Saturday and Sunday so fans didn't miss out, wouldn't they do the same thing with Rock? What if they do Reigns against Rock on night one, and the winner, being Rock, against Sami Zayn or Cody on night two? Would that work? I get Rock having a title reign for 24 hours is silly, but what if Sami wins the WWE title from The Rock at WrestleMania? The Usos and Solo help Rock win night one, and then they help Sami win night two. This leads to fun TV with Sami as the WWE champion, with the Usos and Solo by his side, and it leads to a feud with Solo and months down the road, a babyface Roman Reigns returning. I don't like that at all. Let me back up here. You're going to have The Rock beat Roman Reigns on night one, and then at the end of all this, Sami Zayn is going to be the WWE champion and lead the bloodline, is what I'm hearing here, because he'll still be with the Usos and Solo Sikoa. Yeah, I don't think so. It's an idea. It's definitely an idea, but it's not one that I would go with. No. If Rock wrestles Roman Reigns beats The Rock. There is no reason for The Rock to come back and beat Roman Reigns. He came in and he beat John Cena 10 years ago because they had an idea in mind for this year-long program where they would do it again, and then he would put over John Cena and pass the torch. That's not what's happening here. If, and it is a very big if, they get The Rock to agree to a match at WrestleMania, that's it. It's one and done. It's probably the last match we will ever see him have. He is not coming in for one last match to beat his cousin. Nor should he. That would be completely ridiculous. So that part of it is just completely fucked. But as far as the WWE title goes, you put the WWE title on Cody and you put the tag team titles on Sami and KO. That's it. That is how you do it. Chris from Phoenix dropped an email. Best of seven series shakeup, he says. Listening to you talk about the trios title, best of seven series in AEW gave me a thought. In sports, a playoff series has an advantage with teams playing at home. What do you think of giving something like the best of seven series an advantage for wrestlers by allowing them to select their gimmick match for their home matches? In my head, the gimmick is the same every match, so if one team or wrestler picks Falls Count Anywhere, that is their home match for their three or four, quote, home matches. What are your thoughts? That's kind of confusing. I think maybe a different gimmick every match after the first one. That could kind of spice things up a little bit, make things interesting. Maybe even let the teams decide based on the winner of a coin flip, right? You flip a coin, whoever wins the coin flip, they get to pick the stip. Whether it's Falls Count Anywhere, no disqualification, cage match, ladder match, you know, whatever it might be. That might be a way to, you know, spice things up a little bit. David from Sacramento, since their run in NXT, Charlotte, Sasha Banks, Becky Lynch, and Bayley have been deemed the four horsewomen in the way that Triple H, HBK, Hall, Nash, and X-Pac were deemed the clique. My question is, if Sasha Banks indeed comes back to WWE, do you see any reason for these four to finally unite on screen as a faction? To me, the only case to finally form this group at this point would be to take over WWE as a whole. I could see Becky returning to NXT and having a run as the women's champion, Sasha and Bayley as tag team champions on both NXT and the main roster, and Charlotte as the SmackDown women's champion. All this leaving Bianca Belair as the final target that even together all four cannot beat. This would eventually lead to the group dissolving into a fatal four-way at WrestleMania with Sasha walking out the victor since the other three have had their individual big match wins. Well, first, I have to correct you. The Clique and the Horsewomen are in no way alike. In no way are they alike. The Clique was formed as a group of friends who watched out for each other on the road. Yeah, they all knew what each other made, what they were being paid to try to make sure they weren't being screwed. Right? They hung out together, they partied together. It was a brotherhood, which wasn't always good news for the other people on the roster. But it was a brotherhood. Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, Bayley, they came through NXT as friends, and some of them still are, but that's where it ends, right? They're all off doing their own thing. They were deemed the horsewomen because there were four of them, and Charlotte's dad was a horseman. None of the other women have any connection to the four horsemen in any way. It sounds marketable. That's why they did it. That's really the only reason for it. Now, having Becky or Sasha or any of them go back to NXT would be a complete waste of them. NXT is the developmental brand now. As it is, Shawn Michaels convinced Triple H to let him have the New Day. Now they're the NXT Tag Team Champions. They're going to be the NXT Tag Team Champions, probably at least until February, so they can try to move more tickets when they're back on the road for that Vengeance Day show. But you're going to have Becky Lynch, who is legitimately one of the biggest stars in the entire company, male or female, spend her time in NXT or half her time in NXT. I mean, that is ridiculous. NXT is the developmental brand now 100%. It is not the black and gold anymore. Becky Lynch, like I said, is one of their biggest stars on the entire roster. Why would you send her back to NXT? The last thing we need is some sort of takeover where they're all overexposed on three different shows. I know you're trying to create some kind of like super faction with this. I don't want to see that. I do think a four-way match one day with all four women could be big if it's built up well. So Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, and Bayley in the ring together, you know, against each other, I think would be a big match. But the rest of this, no way. Absolutely not. And Sasha Banks, by the way, who I don't think is coming back to WWE right now, if she was to come back to WWE, I would like to think that they have a better idea on what to do with her than just put the tag team titles back on her. That's the last thing she was doing before she walked out. I would like to think they could come up with something a little bit better than that. Carl from Dayton, Ohio. On a recent episode of his podcast, Kurt Angle revealed that Brock Lesnar was open to joining TNA in 2007. When Lesnar asked about how much money Angle was making in TNA and Angle told him, Brock said that he would come to TNA if Kurt could get him the same amount. When Angle approached TNA about bringing in Brock, TNA told him that they were not going to give him that kind of money. Assuming what Angle said is legit, and TNA ended up giving him the money and signing Lesnar, how would this have affected TNA, and what are some wrestlers you think would have been paired well with Lesnar at the time? I think that Brock coming back to wrestling for the first time in 3 years, because in 2007 it would have been 3 years. Not counting the stuff he did in Japan for Inoki. If you count it from when he left WWE, he left in 04. So in 07 it would have been 3 years gone. And that would have been a big deal, I think, for the first couple of matches. And then he would have ended up as every other big name on the roster. He would have just been another big name on the roster. I don't think it would have made much of a long-term business difference outside of bleeding them out of money faster. If it would have had a long-term business consequence, it would have been a negative long-term business consequence, which is probably why they said, we're not going to offer him that amount of money. I think he probably could have convinced TNA to bring in Paul Heyman, though. And see, that would have made things easier for Brock. But that would have been very interesting longer term, because if Dixie had Heyman working for her And Paul is a very cunning guy, right? If Paul is working in TNA at the time, who knows what kind of position he would have eventually been able to talk himself into while he was working there. Because I guarantee you that if he came in as a manager for Brock Lesnar in 2007, Paul Heyman wasn't just going to end up being a manager in TNA. Eventually, he would have ascended to a much higher position, whether it was a writer or some other higher position of influence in the company. And that would have been very interesting. See, to me, that's the bigger what-if question. Brock comes in, he does a few big matches, you know, big whoop. Heyman comes in, and that could potentially change the entire culture and future of that company. Now, as far as the TNA roster goes at the time, Kurt Angle would have been the obvious opponent for Brock. Samoa Joe, Abyss. I'm sure Jeff Jarrett would have finagled his way into a match with Brock. And Justin from Soper, Oklahoma. Hey, Solomonster, I just heard the part about Bron Breakker and Apollo Crews in the diner. Match pitch time. Greasy spoon / eat at Joe's match. All the competitors meet at a local diner and order their food. When everybody has their food, then the match begins. All the competitors fight to be the first to eat their entire meal while keeping the others from eating theirs. Of course, everybody would be required to order a large meal to keep someone from cheating by ordering something as simple as a small glass of water. I didn't know that people ordered a glass of water when they go to a diner. I guess I've just been very lucky here in New York with all the diners I've ever been to. I get it for free without even asking. How much is a small glass of water going for these days, by the way? If your meal is completely eaten by someone else or your food is rendered inedible, then you are tossed out of the match. If you intentionally destroy an opponent's food, then you are thrown out, not them. Finally, all your food must be eaten unless entirely ruined, even if it's been thrown on the floor, dumped in the garbage, the toilet, etc. What do you think? I have absolutely no idea what I just read. But maybe AEW can add another championship for it. I don't think they have enough of those. Justin, it's very creative. I'll give you that. But I don't really know what to say to that. So I'll just say that you can email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @solomonster and subscribe on YouTube as we try to climb our way up to 72,000 subscribers. I can't do that without you. So head on over there. Of course, we have all of our usual weekly live streams and we have some special features coming up here on the show as we approach the end of the year that I'm very excited to work on for you. I'm going to be back here for episode 787 next Sunday. We are winding down the year, the final sound-offs of 2022, in what is our 15th year. So thank you for all the love. Be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Hopefully I will see some of you next Saturday at the House of Glory show. And I'll see you back here again next Sunday for 787. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
We had Butch taking on Ludwig Kaiser. So Butch targeted the fingers of Kaiser. Kaiser rolled to the floor. Kaiser rolled. Oh, I just popped myself. Kaiser roll. I fucking love it. I'm going to take a drink of that. Sometimes it's the little things that amuse me the most. Oh, man. Kaiser roll to the floor. I promise you, Sean, I was not. I didn't have that in my back pocket. I was not waiting for the rim shot. Sometimes these things just come together in a perfect way.
The Solomonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.